It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for listening in today. We have a really fascinating show, and I want to just jump right into it because we have a lot of things to talk about, maybe some things that you really even haven't thought about, and yes, they're all related to food, in my opinion. So we're going to talk a little more globally than we normally do, and I'm going to bring on Mia McDonald, who's the executive director of Brighter Green, and she's based in New York, as is Brighter Green, which she directs, and she's a public policy analyst and writer who has worked as a consultant to a range of international non-governmental organizations, including the Ford Foundation, the World Wildlife Fund, the Greenbelt Movement, the Sierra Club, Save the Children, as well as several United Nations agencies, among others, on issues of environment, gender, sustainable development, women's rights and gender equality, reproductive health and population and conservation and animal protection. She has published many articles in popular and environmental media, authored a number of policy papers and reports, and has contributed to four books, including Nobel Peace Laureate Wangari Maathai's best-selling autobiography, Unbowed. She is a senior fellow of the World Watch Institute and has taught in the Human Rights Program at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and the Environmental Studies Program at New York University. She serves as a director on the boards of Farm Sanctuary, Food Empowerment Project, and the Greenbelt Movement International North America. She received a master's degree in public policy from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University and a BA with honors from Columbia University. And I am so honored to be able to be talking with you today, Mia. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Gosh. Karen, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I visit your website, brightergreen.org, whenever I can, and I've seen some of your YouTube videos, and this work is I'm out of words. It's amazing. It's overwhelming. It's in some ways inspiring, in some ways very depressing, and there's a lot of things that are going on out there, but I am so glad that we have someone like you who's digging in and reporting on these issues.
Well, you're very kind to say that, and I have a huge respect for what you're doing as well, so I'm really pleased to hear that you're looking at the website and you find the materials useful. Should we talk a little bit about what that work is for
yes,
a few minutes?
Yes, please. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one of the projects that Brighter Green has been working on for the past couple of years, and the work will likely continue, and that it's related to what Karen has just mentioned, is looking at, through the lens of climate change, the globalization of industrial animal agriculture. And again, it's a big mouthful of words, and mm-hmm. many of you will be familiar, and Karen, you obviously know, the term factory farming. So basically, the increase in consumption of meat and dairy products and the intensification of the methods used to produce those animals in the rest of the world. We're specifically looking at some of the large developing countries, countries like China, India, Brazil, and Ethiopia, and so trying to really get to the bottom of and document a number of issues, so spanning, as I mentioned initially, climate change, but also looking at issues of public health, resource use, you know, what does this phenomenon mean for water, for land, livelihoods, you know, small farmers, women farmers, certainly animal welfare, issues of equity, public health, you know, some of the diseases of affluence associated with the way we eat are just skyrocketing. I mean, in India, there are 40 million people with diabetes already. In China, almost 90 million people with diabetes. And we know these kind of conditions are preventable. And yet the system we've developed in the U.S., unfortunately, this intensive production model, exploitation of animals, of the environment, of the climate, is being sent around the world. And so we're trying to bring that to greater public attention, policymaker attention, media attention, through a series of policy papers, as you mentioned, as well as a number of videos. And we're actually about to upload two more videos for India, looking at the dairy and beef industries, which are growing quite substantially in India. Despite it being a traditionally vegetarian nation, there is a lot of increased consumption around animal foods.
Well, this is very depressing, Mia,
because,
you know, we're trying as hard as we can, some of us just trying to improve things in our own great country, and people just seem to want to repeat all of our mistakes. And I would like to think we're at a point now where we've industrialized enough and we've realized the benefits and the disadvantages, and now we can hopefully start working on the things that don't work well, and it's a big fight, but I'd like to think we're getting more information out there about how factory farming is devastating on our individual health because we're eating too much meat and dairy. It's devastating on the environment because we know it's a major factor in global warming, and it's horrifically cruel. I mean, we know all of these things now, and yet why are people copying what we're doing? It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, I agree with you, and there are certainly days when I find it extremely depressing. I think a couple things are going on. I mean, one is, the average person in China or India or even Brazil, if they really knew what the U.S. food system and this industrial agriculture had created, and especially for animals and meat and dairy products, I don't think that they would choose that and would say, we want that in our country, given all of the downsides that are being, you know, documented extremely well, I would say, in the U.S. But that process, of documentation is not as far advanced in some of these other countries. And it doesn't mean that people don't experience some of these realities. In China, water pollution is a huge problem. And a lot of that now is documented to be from livestock facilities, including factory farms. So, you know, people are experiencing that. People are obviously experiencing climate change. China had a huge drought. India's had failed monsoons in the past couple of years, which is a huge challenge for their food production, for livelihoods, for irrigation, for electricity, for a whole range of development, realities. So I think, on the other side, we can say the forces that have produced this system in the U.S. are looking globally, you know, and if they can put a hamburger in the hands of 1.3 billion people in China, that's only going to increase profits and only going to increase the bottom line, again, because of these costs are not accounted for, right? So McDonald's can operate in China, Smithfield can operate in China, Tyson can operate in China, and, I mean, an unfortunate part, and this is where I would say I agree with you, it's depressing, a lot of the governments of these countries actually do support this system and do see what we've created in the U.S. as producing a lot of food for a lot of people at very low prices, and unfortunately see what's happened in the U.S. as, you know, sort of the way of the future, as this is modern, this is progress, this is what we have to do ourselves to become industrialized nations. But I would say that, again, a number of these policymakers, I don't think, are really aware of the downsides. And for many of them, the issue of even the relationship between climate change and animal agriculture is a new topic because, frankly, it has not gotten a lot of attention in the global policy arena. And so, you know, I think that that's partly what Brighter Green is trying to do. But I would say to people listening, the work that people are doing in the U.S., on this set of issues, it is huge in and of itself, but it is extremely important for the rest of the world. Excuse me, I'm just going to have a quick sip of water. It's people around the world who see what we're doing here. So obviously if the U.S., if a critical mass of people here begins questioning the system, begins pushing back against the system, which may well be happening, that certainly could have an influence on how this story plays out in India, in China, in Brazil, even in a place like Ethiopia, which is at a very different level of development, yet a huge livestock producer. So yeah. I think there's, we all have to do our work where we're doing it, but I think there are a lot of intersections and possibility for collaboration and solidarity between those of us working in the U.S. and those of us working on the set of issues internationally.
Right. I have a whole bunch of different thoughts and questions. So I was reading an article on your site, and then you just mentioned how other governments are realizing they can feed a lot of people this way and cheaply. Now, my understanding in the United States is that our meat and dairy products are so cheap because they're highly subsidized and we all pay for them with our taxes, so we're not even seeing the true cost of these foods, and it would really be a lot cheaper to grow a bean than it would be to grow beef. And yet you wrote, or I forget who, I wish I remember what article I read it in, but where in India the chicken is cheaper than the dal. And are they subsidized? Is the government subsidizing it as well? How do they manage to get the cost so low?
Yeah, it's a great question, actually. Some of the ways they get to have the cost so low is the grain is still relatively cheap. I mean, that will likely change as we see changes in world food markets and as India has to import more grain to feed livestock. And that's a challenge that's facing many countries now. They can't, you know, produce enough grain to feed this burgeoning population of farmed animals. That's one reason. The government doesn't actively subsidize the industry in the way that we understand subsidies, but they certainly have put programs in, national programs, to help the industry, to provide low-cost loans, to encourage this intensification. You know, again, unfortunately, even in India with its vegetarian heritage, the government sees a growing middle class that has developed a taste for Western-style food. It's also being marketed to them insistently along with other Western products. And so their response is, well, then we need to produce more chicken, more beef even, you know, even in India, more dairy products. And the governments also have their eyes on export markets. And so there's a distortion here, right, because the full costs are not being borne in terms of cost to the environment, in terms of these, you know, government, let's say, easements, if not exactly subsidies. But India is now such a low-cost producer of chicken that it is looking for export markets. So we have a huge irony of a country like India, yes, increasing wealth for some, but dire poverty and malnutrition for millions of people in India still, that may well use its resources, you know, grain, water, land, everything else, to export cheap chicken to wealthier countries. And I, you know, when you look at something like that, it does feel like we live in a crazy helter-skelter world. We know we do.
Amen.
In many ways.
Well, in India, where they have all kinds of food security issues, what would be some of the solutions to feed that population? And I certainly don't believe it's making more chicken, but how do we get food to the poor in India?
Yeah, I mean, again, a very good and very important question. One thing that I think might not be as well known, and I didn't know as much about this until I really dug into the research, is even though we think if we eat at an Indian restaurant here in the United States, there's a huge array of vegetables and pulses and, you know, just a great variety of food. In India itself, that wide variety of vegetables and even sometimes legumes, you know, pulses, beans, lentils, are not broadly available to an average poor person, if there is such a thing as an average poor person. That relates to, you know, long-time agricultural policy. We can bring in the Green Revolution here, which really stressed producing a large quantity of specific grains, right? So wheat, so rice, corn, soy production is increasing in India. But again, it's not to make tofu. It's really for animal feed. There's been a, you know, many decades of an agricultural policy, again, pioneered in the West and promoted by some of our institutions globally to poor countries to really invest in these large commodity crops. One could argue that that perhaps has provided India with some food security, but in terms of issues of malnutrition, in terms of where does the country go? How does it use its resources? It still has a growing population. So, you know, water, land is under pressure, you know, as we speak, and that will only increase. One of the things that we recommend is the government really look at food security and prioritize assuring that every Indian can have a variety of nutritious plant-based foods. So not basing food security on increasing animal products and production of animal products, but really looking at many of the cuisines in India, how varying they are in nutritious greens, in legumes, and ensuring that people have access to that, which actually at this point they don't. That's one because of prices, others because of availability, sometimes because of infrastructure, and also because many farmers have shifted to growing these commodity crops, as they're called, and do not cultivate vegetables, do not cultivate fruit. I just saw some research that only about 3% of India's land is planted with vegetables, right? And mm-hmm. more than half of its land is planted with these large commodity grain crops that I've mentioned. So I think that's an important facet. I think in terms of, you know, public health, as I mentioned, I think when we began the interview, you know, things like diabetes, obesity are rising extremely rapidly in India, as they are in China. That's also another issue the government needs to get its hands on more and create incentive for consumption of healthier food. And that may well mean things like subsidies. You know, so chicken is not cheaper than something like dal, which mm-hmm. if you really looked at the cost of producing those to the land, you know, pesticides, everything else, it could not turn out that way, that it really makes more sense, even from an economic case, given the environmental cost, to produce chicken so cheaply. So it's a false economy at this point, and unfortunately it has multiple ramifications.
Well, we hear governments and corporations talking about solutions to food security all the time. Monsanto is famous for promoting their genetically modified foods, saying they're going to solve all of the world's hunger problems. And yet these issues that you brought up in terms of access, distribution, none of those things are solved with any of these newer foods, meats, or genetically modified foods. So those same poor people, how do they get any of those foods?
Right, absolutely. And that, again, to me, is government policy. It's civil society holding governments accountable, demanding more rational, more equitable policies on food security, not allowing these kind of false solutions that you just laid out to go unchallenged, because that's obviously an argument for things like factory farming. You know, mm-hmm. the meat and dairy industry will say, well, look at population growth. There are going to be 3 billion more people on the planet by 2050. They have to be fed. You know, we can't have 100 billion free-range chickens. We have to bring them all inside. But obviously that's based on an assumption that animal-based foods have to be at the center of people's diets, that it's ethical to do so, and that also that there are enough natural resources to produce and support that population of animals. And again, I think, unfortunately, even in a country like Ethiopia, where there's huge issues of land degradation because there are many, many livestock, principally free-range at this point, but, you know, there are so many of them that the land is degraded from overgrazing. And also there's been drought in recent years, much of it. Now, on the one hand, the government can see, and there is some evidence that this is the case, sees, well, let's move the animals inside. Then we don't have to worry about them destroying the land.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, what we've seen in the United States is, one is obviously the cruelty, many pollution problems and other issues with concentrated animal feeding operations, as they're so euphemistically called, but also the challenge of how are those animals to be fed? That the grain has to be produced, where is it going to be produced, and what kind of ecological and social cost is that? Now, I will tell you something that might make your hair stand on end. That Cargill, you know, a U.S. grain giant, and actually a global grain giant, officials from Cargill have been seen in Ethiopia scoping out, you know, is this a place where we could produce grain?
And as we know, is this a place that we can rape and make lots of money?
Yeah, and grain is, you know, principally for animal feed and biofuel to some degree, and those have enormous ecological and social costs. And as you mentioned previously, the benefits of this kind of development model, of economic model, basically go to the haves. The people who already have things will have more of them, as opposed to spreading the benefits more broadly across the population. And again, I think that that's an issue, that issue of equity, that needs more attention and some more sunlight on that.
Okay. I am beyond convinced about the horrors of factory farming and how terrible it is, and the idea that it's expanding is a terrible nightmare because it should be globally illegal to have these places. But then to free range, free graze animals, certainly there's not enough landmass to grow the quantity of animals that are being eaten today. So people would have to eat more, less, not more, and the trends certainly look like people are eating more. But you mentioned this thing about land degradation from animals grazing. And I know there's organizations like, you must be familiar with Heifer International. And I don't know if you have any thoughts about them, but I know that they're very popular in schools today in the United States and appeal to a lot of the sensitivities of very compassionate people who want to help this food security issue. And the idea is to get animals to poor people so that they can have a livelihood and get milk and help them. Do you agree with this concept, or is there a better way to go?
Yeah, well, I think that there are a number of things going on there as well. One thing you mentioned, grazing, and I guess what I should also say is in a number of countries, India, China, many we can name, because of the pressure on the land, because of the hunger for land, you know, among a growing population and also large agribusiness that is quite keen to plant more soy or more corn or more wheat, or more even biofuel crops. There is a trend towards what is called zero grazing that you might be familiar with. So actually, instead of the cow being out grazing on its own or in a herd for most of the day, that cow would be penned. So it's not a factory farm, but it's basically a cow, or let's say three or four cows or maybe 10 cows, in a small pen. So they basically live in that pen most of their life, and they are fed, so either fodder, which could be grasses or different kind of crops that are grown, or in some cases commercial feed, are brought to them. So my understanding of some of the heifer projects, especially the ones that have cows and goats and sheep, is that those animals would actually be part of a zero grazing system.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in a place like Rwanda, a woman might have a couple of cows, but they're basically penned in. So on animal welfare grounds, we can say, well, that's not very good, right? I mean, in terms of raising animals for food, we can also object to that on many levels. But in terms of, it's not really a free-range animal anymore. I think the argument that heifer makes, as you say, I think it is appealing to people because it seems low cost. It seems like a charitable endeavor. I have talked to people at Heifer, and one thing I should say is the scale of Heifer's efforts is at this point not enormous. So in terms of, if you look at trends of factory farming and intensification, you know, the Heifer animals are a drop in the bucket of that.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, I think that there are certainly questions about the Heifer model in terms of animal welfare, also in terms of environment, right? Because in a place like Rwanda, where I know Heifer is quite active, and I've heard some good things about their programs there, but Rwanda is a very densely populated country. And, you know, already there's huge shortages of land for people who want land to grow crops or produce crops at a small-scale level. So to bring a significant population of cattle or to add to the population of cattle in a place like Rwanda strikes me as problematic, you know, in terms of how are those animals going to be fed?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are the trade-offs in producing feed for those animals versus producing feed for people? I mean, another trend, of course, and I think heifer is part of this, I don't know exactly for sure, is in many of these countries, there are indigenous breeds of animals, right? But they have not been bred to be milk machines or dairy machines or egg machines. But as agribusiness comes in and as the Western model comes in, those animals are being replaced by Western bred animals.
Machines.
So, you know, Holstein cows that produce 10, 20, 30 times as much milk as an average Indian cow would. Now, again, we know they've been bred. We know they've been manipulated to do that. So that's a challenge ethically, I think. But also, they need to be fed so much more to maintain that level of production. So again, in terms of an ecological footprint, it's much, much heavier. And so I think that to question some of the programs of heifer and others on those grounds is also legitimate. I mean, we also have global warming, right? And so we know that cows contribute a lot to that. Yes, a factory farmed cow contributes more because it's being fed more. But as these breeds from the U.S. and Europe become embedded in agriculture in developing countries, the emissions per animal is also going to rise, you know, and that is, again, a big ecological challenge. So That's what I would say on that.
Okay. I like it. There's a word that you use in one of your papers, soyanization, and it's something I haven't seen before. I don't know if it's a very popular word, but can you talk about what it is?
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think we put the word in quotes because it isn't, you know, a term in common usage. But soyanization is a phenomenon that's been identified in principally in Latin America so far, where much of the agriculture or the agricultural economy is increasingly dominated by soy. So Argentina is a huge producer of soy, which has crowded out diversity of other crops, also tied Argentina so closely to global trends in demand for soy, prices for soy. So there's been a lot of criticism among farming communities in Argentina of why has the government and agribusiness, you know, promoted this soyanization, because it has multiple downsides. We're losing diversity. When the soy price falls out, you know, farmers are really they can be burdened by debt. There's huge amount of chemicals and, you know, pesticides used to produce soy. There's obviously GM soy, you know, Roundup Ready soy, that's becoming increasingly popular, produced by Monsanto. So it's a critique of being so heavily tied to soy. We see a similar phenomenon in Brazil, where the production of soy is rapidly increasing. And again, just to underline a point we've been talking about throughout the program so far, you know, the soy is not for the tofu eaters of the world. It's for livestock. But it becomes almost a bit of a vicious cycle. So that's why the term soyanization is used and why it's increasingly criticized.
Okay. Now, I've been reading lots of different things about things going on in Africa, and I read something about Hillary Clinton recently saying that we should be giving them more funding to help their food security issues, and I'm just wondering how much is the funding from the United States involved in any of these projects, and are we doing good things for food security, or are we helping to support the corporations that are continuing these problematic ways of making food?
Yeah, I think we're doing both, actually. It's interesting because when you see Obama, who's just been on his tour in the Midwest, talking to farmers and talking about, you know, we want to help farmers, sometimes we hear him say it, sometimes we don't actually hear it. But part of that process is opening markets for U.S. farm products. Now, on the one hand, we might say, well, that's great. You know, if an apple grown in Washington State can go to China, we might think that's good. Climate change implications, I mean, that's a complex topic. But part of that is increasing markets for U.S. beef, for pork, for chicken, for soy, for corn. So in that way, U.S. policy is promoting, one could say, intensification of animal agriculture, rising meat consumption in countries overseas. You know, a couple years ago, there was a big fight between the U.S. and South Korea over beef, and South Korea had banned that because of fears about mad cow disease. You know, there was some criticism of the Korean government as trying to protect Korean beef producers. You know, again, many issues going on. But Tom Vilsack, the current Secretary of Agriculture, paid a visit to Korea, and one of his main points was trying to reopen that market for U.S. beef. And as we know, in the U.S., that's going to be almost absolutely all feedlot-raised, factory-farmed beef. So that's a problem. And, you know, when Hillary Clinton travels some places, you know, sometimes there are agribusiness executives along on the trip, you know, whether it's Monsanto or Cargill or others. So, you know, that's certainly a negative part of it. On the other hand, I would say, from what I understand, and I'm actually not an expert, I should say this, on kind of U.S. you know, food policy in terms of developing countries or in terms of aid to developing countries, I do think there is a growing awareness of some of the inequities in how agricultural funding has been doled out in past years, that it has tended to go to large producers, that there is a crisis of food security in poor countries in Africa, in Asia, and other regions, and that there is a refocusing on some of these core issues of how do we really create food security that is ecologically sustainable. Now, I think that that process is probably in the early stages. How far that goes, how long that goes, I couldn't say at this point.
Okay.
Yeah, so good and bad, as in many things.
So we're pretty much at the end of the half hour, and I just wanted to, maybe you could sum things up or tell the listeners some things that they could do and some inspiring things to make a brighter green place.
Okay. I would say, I mean, if people would like to come to the website, brightergreen.org, and read some more about the issues I've discussed. So we have these policy papers as well as short versions of them, policy briefs, and the videos that Karen mentioned, looking at India, China, Brazil, and Ethiopia. So you can get a sense of how these issues that you may well know quite a bit about in the United States are playing out in these different countries, in these large, important countries that, you know, we should care about because of their size, their influence, and also because millions and millions of people live in them. And, you know, we're obviously all living on the same planet. I would also say to educate oneself about what's happening globally can be quite important as people have conversations in their own arenas in the United States, you know, whether it's with colleagues, whether it's with policymakers, whether it's with media, to try to bring greater awareness to the sense that, you know, we've seen these things in the United States, this intensification, this commodification, the downsides of it. It's happening globally, and we also need to be aware of that, even if we're not working on it actively. I think that there's a lot of areas for information exchange.
Yeah. I was just thinking of one more thing that I wanted to mention, and that is I know you're familiar with T. Colin Campbell's work, The China Study, and it's so frustrating because he worked with the Chinese and studied so many and discovered all their great health benefits in those that ate a lot of vegetables and less meat, and now we see that their health is degrading so much over there with all the diabetes you're talking about.
Yes, I agree with you, but unfortunately that's not inspiring, but I mean his work is.
But his work is getting a lot of attention here now,
yeah,
so that's
and
very hopeful.
And I was
hopeful.
In China earlier this year, and you know, my colleagues and I also did talk about Colin Campbell's research. I would say it's probably not as well known in China as it could be among this generation of policymakers, and I know that he's working on that and others are working on that. And I think, unfortunately, there's a huge power of meat and dairy's association with affluence, with modernity, with a vision of progress that I do think government officials are very entranced by. And that's where I think it's up to many of us to try to, you know, sort of take the scales off of their eyes and show them what the reality is.
Well, we still have that a lot here, too, that same image. That image is changing a little bit with popular celebrities who are starting to talk about plants as being healthy and being slim and giving us longevity, but a lot of people still equate meat and dairy with making it.
Precisely, and unfortunately that association, which, you know, probably has roots somewhere in many cultures, but has been amplified by the role of meat and dairy in U.S. culture and economy, unfortunately. Now, in terms of inspiring, I would say, even as I talk about the global litany of ills around this set of issues, there are people in China, in Brazil, in India, who are working on this from different angles, whether it's animal welfare, water pollution, food security. There are a number of vegetarian restaurants in China, and the number is increasing, and a number of the people who own those are actually activists on this set of issues. So to me, that is encouraging, that, you know, this is a global challenge. Many people in the U.S. have done some really important work on this over the past 20 years, and it's great to see that getting attention. Karen, as you say, these issues getting, you know, more media focus and more popular currency. So on the one hand, yes, we have a huge challenge of the train is out of the station globally, but there are people in the rest of the world, in the developing world, who are aware, who are working on this. And I think what I want to explore further, and I hope others will as well, is looking for ways that we can share information, that we can support each other, that we can be in a network of solidarity. So experiences here have relevance in other countries, and similarly, experiences in other countries have relevance for what we do here and how we understand, you know, ourselves and our world and this set of challenges.
Thank you so much, Mia. Mia McDonald, Executive Director of Brighter Green. Please visit the website, brightergreen.org, and download those wonderful position papers. There's a lot of great information there. If you've got kids in high school that need to report on the environment, this is the place to get a lot of wonderful information, and we need to be sharing it. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay. We're going to take a very quick break, and we're going to come back with a sweeter side for you, and we're going to be talking with Lois Dieterle, who is the cookbook author of Sinfully Vegan. So stay with us. And you're listening to It's All About Food. And we are about to be in our second part of today's show, and I'm going to bring on Lois Dieterle, who is a former baker and currently elementary school teacher living outside in Reading, Pennsylvania with her family. And her book, Sinfully Vegan, has recently been re-released with new recipes. And we're going to talk about that right now. Lois, welcome to It's All About Food.
Hi.
Hi. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. How about you?
Okay. Well, you know, there's lots of reasons to eat plant foods, and I don't know if you heard of any of the earlier part of the show, but a lot of it can be really overwhelming when we think about what's going on with animal agriculture today and its impact on the environment. And sometimes, you know, it's so overwhelming, I don't want to think about it. And the good news is we can think about all kinds of luscious, delicious plant-based treats.
Absolutely.
And save the planet at the same time.
You know, people say to me, I couldn't be vegan. I like my food to taste good. And they're just so wrong. They don't know how wrong that they are, that I found so many delicious things to eat that are safe for the environment and much healthier for your body.
Well, this is what I like talking about most. I love talking about food, and I love talking about the real gooey, delicious food.
Good stuff.
Now, your book's called Sinfully Vegan, and I don't think it's a sin to eat this food at all.
No, it's not, but it looks sinful, so we call it that.
Right. Well, a lot of people like to think they're doing something wrong.
Right. I'm a vegan with a sweet tooth, and I didn't want to give it up. And frankly, when I first started being vegan, which was about 15 years ago, the baked goods were just starting to come out. People were experimenting, and there definitely wasn't much commercially, which is why I came out with this book, just to help share my what I learned so that other people could eat it too, because I like sweets.
Well, I'm always talking about people getting back into the kitchen, and it's to make anything, the savory foods or the sweet foods. It's so important to know what's in your food and know how to make it. And especially if you've got kids, they love making things in the kitchen.
Right. And I think going back to your last show, I was listening to that, and I'm interested in E. Colin Campbell's work. And the one thing that stuck with me is that he said, eat as close to nature as possible. And that's why people do have to get back into the kitchen. It's okay to eat sweets, but make it yourself so it doesn't have all that funny stuff in that you can't pronounce.
People have no idea what's in their food.
Right.
And there are so many wonderful recipes in your book, and they're made with ingredients that people know how to pronounce. They know what they are. They're recognized from plant sources. And, gosh, it's scary sometimes when you read a loaf of bread or a cookie.
Absolutely.
And if you can read the letters, because a lot of people have problems seeing small print today.
Right. Well, that's why I get a magnifying glass out. I don't need anything that I don't read the ingredients on.
But just hydrogenated oils. You talk about oil a bit in your book, and you do it in a language that people can understand, which is very important. You know, we don't have to be rocket science to understand how to eat healthfully.
Right, but it is confusing, so I try to explain it on a level, like you said, that people can understand, because I'm just, an average person so I explained it that way, to the average person picking up a cookbook. This is what it means to you, so you know how to eat healthfully, because there are so many oils out there, and not all of them are bad. I think we threw the baby out with the bathwater with this fat-free stuff, and that's not healthy either.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a believer in eating foods that are minimally processed or minimally refined. So personally, I like to get my fats from raw nuts and seeds, avocado, whole coconut. And then occasionally when I have a treat, I will use Earth Balance margarine or olive oil, some simple organic oils. I don't eat a lot of them, but if I'm having a treat, I want it to taste good.
Right, and be healthy. I mean, that's what I try to say in this book. These are still desserts, so you can't eat them with abandon, but they are much healthier, but they're a treat.
Mm-hmm. Now, I just want to talk about, okay, there's a lot of recipes in here, and there's certainly lots that would satisfy a lot of different tastes. But a few that I found interesting or amusing, you have the banana cannoli.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Sure, Ken. That's one of my new ones. I was kind of flirting with some of the almost raw food type thing. I don't know a lot about raw foods, but that's where this inspiration came from. And I do like cannolis, the idea of that. So that's where that came from. And I have been playing around with avocado and discovered how it makes such a creamy base. So I was playing with that. The chocolate has a strong flavor to go with that. So it makes avocado makes a wonderful base for a whipped cream.
Mm-hmm.
So it has that chocolate avocado cream on the inside of it, and then the shell is just simply dehydrated bananas. So it's very simple, and it's much healthier than a regular cannoli. And I found it absolutely delicious. And all my tasters, it's just very different, easy, and delicious.
Yeah, I haven't tried it yet, but I am definitely going to check that one out. I just love the whole idea of it. And I haven't seen anything like it.
It's different. I said that my daughter lives in California, so I get a little bit of the West Coast ideas from her. So we sit down and we brainstorm, and she's a foodie also. talk food, and she's very much into the health and things, but she gets that whole different mindset from California. There is much more of a raw food influence, the Tex-Mex or the Mexican food, or well, her husband's from Texas. That's where the Tex-Mex comes from, but a whole different idea. So that's where, you know, we were just spinning a whole lot of things around, and that's where it came from.
Now, you're currently an elementary school teacher.
Yes, I am.
And what grades, what ages do you teach?
Six. Intermediate.
Okay, uh-huh. That's a very interesting age.
It is an interesting age. And I'm not in the classroom anymore. I'm a math remediation person, but I used to love being in the classroom because I would teach nutrition and I would introduce the students to a more plant-based diet. When we had parties, we would make food together, healthy, dessert, snacky things like fruit salad, and put it in an ice cream cone with coconut sprinkled on top or something. So it was a fun food, and that's where some of the things came from in the chapter, not just for kids,
mm-hmm.
that are kind of fun kinds of treats, but I like them too.
Right. Did you, when you were making these treats with the kids, were you explaining why you were not using dairy and eggs?
Absolutely.
And,
they really knew where I was coming from and tried to understand it. They were very much, this was new to them, and they were very curious, as kids will be at that age.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a lot of nice dialogues about that, and they were very eager to try things. That age child likes to try new things, and they were open.
Did any of them go home to their parents and say, I don't want to eat these foods anymore?
The foods that
like
the parents
the
had?
Meat and milk and eggs and
some of them told me that they did.
Yeah, so, I mean, sometimes
I don't know. I didn't have any parents coming into me, you know, one way or the other. But some of them had announced that they were going to stop doing that and that they loved eating it this way. I did actually have some parents come in and years later, and they said they remembered when I had done some of those things and that they did like that. Now, whether or not it changed their idea or their way of living, I don't know. But I hope I opened their eyes that they're willing now to explore it.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of the problems today with food in schools is, okay, the food that we have is just horrific, refined, and too much sugar and the wrong fats, et cetera. And a lot of people bring food into the classroom. And more kids now are sensitive to wheat and peanuts, and there are just so many more allergies coming around. I'm not sure when you were a teacher if you were exposed to any of this, but how do you handle that?
It's a difficult problem. And I think schools are starting to change now and not allowing as many foods to be brought in. And we don't have at our school peanut butter anymore because of some of the allergies. And it's a difficult problem because of all the sensitivities.
Yeah, but and they're not all the same. There are so many different ones. Yeah.
Right, but schools really have to, in my opinion, start addressing the healthy foods. I know I had an issue with my school that, and I did address it. I had written a 7-page letter to them because they were talking about healthy breakfast, but they were giving the kids French toast sticks and fruity flavored cereal with fruit drink on it. And, you know, well, the kids would pour the fruit drink on it, but I mean, it just was not a healthy breakfast. So either give them a healthy breakfast or at least don't call it a healthy breakfast. Because we're in the position of being educators, and we have to set an example and help kids.
You know, right.
This is where they learn.
Yep. I got a little distracted here because I was looking at your orange creamsicle smoothie. And, when I was a kid, I used to really love those creamsicles, those frozen pops with the orange sherbet coating and the vanilla ice cream inside.
I love them. That's where that came from. I love that.
And so I'm looking at this, and it's so simple. It's just crushed ice, orange juice, vanilla vegan milk, and vanilla extract. And I'm thinking not only would it be a great shake, but you could probably put it in those molds and make a nice frozen pop with it.
The freeze pop. Yes, I do have a section on some freeze pops, but any of the smoothies you could freeze as well. But I have some that have just the fruit purees and then a little bit of a tofu cream because I like a cream swirl through it, which you can or you don't have to do, but I just love those in the summertime.
I don't drink a lot of orange juice because it doesn't feel, I get a little sensitive, but I think if I made it like this and just sipped slowly on it, I think I'm going to try that very, very soon.
One of my favorite recipes in here that I have all the time at this time of year because you can get the organic cherries and they're not too outrageously expensive is the chocolate cherry ice cream. It's just frozen bananas, frozen cherries, and just a little bit of water and cocoa, and you just spin that up in a food processor, and I love it. And then I put chopped up almonds on it as well because I like crunch my ice cream, but such a treat. It's like a soft serve ice cream.
Well, the amazing thing is not all of the recipes here, but many of them have just a handful of ingredients. They're really simple to make. Some are a little more involved, the Boston cream pie and some other things, but most of them are really easy and just amazingly good, and I always like to encourage people to have these things because they can be healthy, and they really satisfy those crazy sweet cravings that we have, and there's really no need to have all that junk that's out there.
Right, absolutely. I mean, my recipes run the gamut from very simple and very healthy to more the fancier ones and some that they're still vegan, but they're not quite as healthy, you know, with the ingredients that are in them. But it's to satisfy everything. Some are definitely a treat. Others you can eat every day, and it doesn't really matter. So it's trying to satisfy everyone. And
What's it like being vegan in Reading, Pennsylvania? I haven't been there in a very long time. I went to college in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, and I had some friends that were from Reading, and that was a long time ago. And I remember Reading not being as sophisticated as, let's say, New York City.
Well, it's the middle of Pennsylvania Dutch country, Pennsylvania German. So, you know, that's the meat and potatoes and lard in the pie crust and that type of thing. So I tend not to use the word vegan here. I just tell people I do not eat any kind of animal product, and I have severe dairy allergies, the way I explain it. the times that I do eat out, so that I get people to take me seriously. So it is definitely a challenge to eat out here.
Yeah, so they're still doing the lard and the pie crust.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I thought lard went out a long time ago.
It's in the farmer's markets and all that. It's, you know, that's the way it's done.
Right. What about organic food? Is there a...
That's starting to be more available. There are some places at the farmer's market that do deal in organic, so that's getting a lot easier. And some of the larger grocery stores are carrying a better supply of the organic food, so that is getting much easier to get.
And
I think that is important. It's just much less stress on your body, I feel, when you eat organic.
Right. well on your body and also in the environment. There's
right.
there's a lot of farming in Pennsylvania, and
yes, there is.
And with the herbicides and pesticides, it gets into the soil, it gets into the water, and then it gets into our bodies.
Right, right. It's like dominoes. So it's mm-hmm. something that we really should start getting away from. And I'm glad to see that there is a much bigger interest in the organic gardening, farming, and that kind of thing here in Pennsylvania.
Well, I want to tell you, I live in New York City, and I was in, what book? I think it was a Barnes & Noble just the other day, and I saw your book.
Okay.
So I like to see
that's
books
exciting.
Like that in major cities and everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
What's exciting nowadays is most of the big bookstores, if they're still in business, have actual vegetarian and vegan book sections.
Right. They're getting larger all the time. I've been noticing as I go by and I look at them. But I think it's also interesting. I did see that my book is on my Kindle. So they are getting them out wireless as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was exciting. I don't know how many cookbooks because I didn't really look in that section, but I was looking for something else and it came up.
So right. So do you
that's something exciting.
Are you planning any other cookbooks or is all your great work in this one?
I don't know. I've been talking to my daughter about doing one, a collaboration where we would do eating healthy cheaply.
A lot of people are interested in that. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. You don't have to spend a lot of money, you know, because we talk about this, that how easy it is to eat healthy, eat those good vegetables, lentils, for example, and you really don't have to spend a lot of money to feed a family. So, you know, that's something that we throw around, but at this point, no firm plans.
Right. Well, it's an important topic because from a lot of angles, I mean, number one, we know that a lot of the food in the stores today, the prices are not real prices. The meat and dairy products are, we're not paying for all of the expense to make those foods at the cash register in the store. A lot of the money is from our tax dollars because they're highly subsidized, and so we're paying
right.
for those foods even if we're not eating them. But even still, buying beans and rice, beans and grains, they have always been the foods that many impoverished people ate, and it nourished them and kept them going
mm-hmm.
for centuries, and those foods are still very inexpensive and still very, very nutritious.
Right, and they can be delicious. You just have to know how to make them.
Absolutely.
But, you know, lentils you can make in almost no time. Quinoa, that's another one of my favorites, which is, you know, not very well known around here anyway. And I just love it. And it's so easy to do so many things with just those two things.
Yeah, I do love quinoa, and I love how easy it is, and I love how nutritious it is. My only concern is we don't really know how to grow it in this country.
I know. That is a problem. You're
yeah.
right. I think there was an area I had read somewhere out in the Midwest where they grew it.
In Colorado, yeah.
That must have been where it is, and I remember thinking that is a downfall.
Yeah,
right.
Can we grow enough quinoa for the world?
Right.
But I think, you know, if we spend time looking into that problem rather than genetically modified food and how to factory farm more efficiently, I think we could figure out how to grow more quinoa sustainably.
I know we could, and I think that would be a much better use of the brain power in this country.
All right. Anyway, I want to encourage people to check out Sinfully Vegan. There's just too many yummy recipes in here. And I want to thank you for speaking with me today on It's All About Food. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, we just have, a couple minutes left, and I wanted to talk about a couple of things. Number one, I invite you to visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. It's a brand new nonprofit that I launched a little over a month ago, and I've got a couple of blog entries that I invite you to read. Most recently, I posted a letter I sent to Hilton Hotels. I was at one of their Hampton Inn suites recently, and talk about their free complimentary breakfast, because although it's great when people offer all kinds of free food, and it's certainly nice when you're at a hotel to get up in the morning and have a free buffet, What's not so nice is when the food is not healthy food, when it's all refined, sugary products, and you can't find non-dairy milks, no soy milks. There's non-dairy creamers that are filled with hydrogenated oils. Everything has high fructose corn syrup in it. The peanut butter isn't just peanuts. It's high fructose corn syrup and other unnatural ingredients. This is when a free breakfast really isn't free. There's too many prices involved, devastation to the environment, cruelty to the animals, and this food is not healthy to eat. And so I'm hoping that Hilton takes notice to my letter, and I invite you to read it, and please do the same and write the businesses that you frequent if they're not doing things the way you think they should be. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think this has been a really interesting show with Mia McDonald of Brighter Green and Lois Dieterle with Sinfully Vegan. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Have a delicious week.